y caballeros, welcome to the latest edition of Raza Voz podcast. Today, keeping in line with our philosophy of trying to be as inclusive as possible and to interview different parts of what we call La Raza, we're going to interview a gentleman who has a Puerto Rican background. The gentleman's name is Mr. Tony Estermeta. Tony has been a lifelong community activist. He originally came from New York City. So I want to begin with asking Tony about his background growing up in New York City. Keeping in mind the way Puerto Rican youth were depicted in the 1950s in New York, I think of 12 Angry Men. I think of the Blackboard Jungle, how there was all these ugly stereotypes in the portrayals of Puerto Rican youth in New York City during that time. So keeping that in mind, Tony, would you mind telling me about your upbringing in New York City, your family, and what it was like to grow up at that time?
Sure. Thank you. Thank you, Carl. We share a very close history with Chicanos on the West Coast, especially here in California. When I was born in Puerto Rico, my folks moved to New York City when I was 5 years old. And I guess I had the same kind of history that Chicanos had, like I mentioned. We have a history in Puerto Rico, just like Mexicans. The government, the U.S. government, basically brought a lot of industry and into Puerto Rico. And what they wanted to do was create a tourist, big, giant tourist attraction. The whole island would become a tourist attraction. And so what they did was basically decolonize Puerto Rico. They went into an agricultural country and created huge unemployment because all those agricultural workers, all the employment was turned from agriculture into tourism, which is obviously completely different industry and completely different skills. And so they created a huge, huge percentage of unemployment on the island. And what they decided to do was, like they've done with the Dominican Republic and what they've done with Mexico, and that is to create a big labor force in the United States. And so they did just like, again, in Mexico, where they had contractors. The government actually contracted with folks, contractors in the United States on the mainland, in Philadelphia, in New York City, in some of the big cities. They were used as the big labor force, as Mexicans were used for the agricultural labor force in California. And so we were moved from an agricultural country to basically an urban country. And so a lot of our folks, and I'm talking about a pretty huge population, over 20% of the island, was then moved to the mainland through these contracts. And folks now were going to work in urban areas in these big cities. And then that was basically the movement, that happened with Puerto Ricans. Like I say, very similar to Mexicans in the move. The only one difference, because all the others, I think, were very identical. The only difference was that Puerto Ricans were considered, not treated like, but considered American citizens for many reasons, because of agreements long ago before World War I. But in any case, so that's why I say it was very similar. It was the very same thing. I didn't speak English, so I went through the same experience that Mexican kids go through when they come to California or the West Coast, go to school, don't know the language. So I had the same kind of educational experience. And the same thing happened, with my parents' employment, with my community, the Puerto Rican community in New York City. Had the same kind of experience that Latinos and Mexicans had on the West Coast all the way through. Growing up, there was no such thing as a Mexican restaurant in New York City. They weren't very Mexicans, as you can imagine. And so I learned and basically became my culture changed, and I basically became a Chico Rican. I dropped out of high school when I was 15, joined the Job Corps in Brooklyn. And they sent me out to Pleasanton in the days in 1965, in the days when Pleasanton was only a bus stop, a Greyhound bus stop. That's all they had there. And a big military base. And there were about 2,500 job corpsmen at the base over the period of time. So it was a pretty huge area, pretty huge base. Met a lot of folks there and met some people from San Jose, corpsmen that were there from San Jose, started coming to San Jose. In 1966, when I got through there, I moved to San Jose with the friends that I met and had. I basically came in the Job Corps. I joined with two of my brothers. My oldest brother had been already been drafted and sent to Vietnam. And so my mom says, you guys got to get out of town. So we joined the Job Corps together. We ended up in Pleasanton. After the training, then we moved to the east side in San Jose. My parents came out with the family at that time, and we moved into Salsipuedes in 1966.
Yeah, I was very curious how a young Puerto Rican guy from New York City ended up in what they used to call the Valley of Heart's Delight. I said, I got to ask him that one because I thought that was really interesting. Now I see how it ended up that you did come over here. Can you compare and contrast the urban setting living versus, say, agricultural, which was the Valley of Heart's Delight back then?
Yeah, you know, the employment is very different. In those days, a lot of the employment was somewhat like right now, you know, every kitchen, even Chinese restaurants, all kitchens are run by Mexicans and other Latinos, but mostly Mexicans. That's the way it was in New York City. Ricans ran all the kitchens. My father for many years worked in the kitchen there and then the women worked in sweatshops because New York City at the time was the center of clothing globally. And so there was a lot of work, and that work was basically women in these huge buildings that had no windows. And that's why they call them sweatshops, very hot, working, 10, 15, 20-hour days, basically, to make a living. With us... kids now, you know, we lived in a cement jungle now, instead of, wonderful open areas with fresh air and so on. Now we lived in a cement jungle. Everything was cement. And then we went to schools where we couldn't speak the language. That was kind of our initial experience there.
I'm just curious. You briefly touched on how the racism existed, the lack of opportunity, the lack of decent educational opportunities. I'm just wondering, what was one of the earliest experiences that you had in terms of social injustice and what it did to you, how you reacted to that experience?
Well, you know, generally for me, it was just being treated differently in school because that was, as a kid, that was kind of the way that we all experienced it, was just that you get treated differently in school. Although we were in ghetto schools, you know, they were still pretty mixed. There were a lot of, there were African-Americans and Puerto Ricans. But at the time, there were also a lot of white folks. And so we were just treated differently. It was just, it was a given, you know, it was just, that's just the way it was. That we were, you know, we were disciplined more. We were treated like we were troublemakers. We were treated as stupid because we spoke a different language, you know, with the same thing. We sometimes got beat up over it. And sometimes, you know, we just got trashed over, you got to speak English and so on. So really, it was the same experience, like I said, that Latinos, Raza, have overall on the West Coast. It's the same experience, just being treated differently, looked at differently, not being able to get good jobs, not being able to go to the best schools. In New York City, at that time, and I probably still, I don't know, but in those days, they had a very strict track system where, most of the minorities were, so they had like, fifth grade would be 5'1", 5'2", 5'3", like that, 6'1", 6'2", 7'1". And then they track people. So if you were in 1-1, you'd be in 2-1, 3-1, 4-1, 5-1. And that's how they segregated. So, as you come along, then the late numbers would be more and more diverse. So, you know, 5'5", 5'10", 5'20", and so on were the dump classes. And generally, that's as I say, it just became more and more diverse until we became exclusively African American and Puerto Rican in the late numbers. I had the personal experience that we moved so many times because of, you know, our economic situation. We moved a lot. And so every time I went to a new school, which was almost every year or every other year, I always would have to make new friends. But I also always ended up in one of those dumb classes at the end. You know, it would be 5'14", you know, 6'18", that kind of thing.
Hmm. You mentioned that you arrived in Northern California, specifically Pleasanton. And I'm aware of how you went to Santa Clara University. Can you talk to me about how you ended up being recruited to go to Santa Clara University and your experiences there as a student activist, combined with the other student activists at San Jose State University, which was really the beginning in many ways of the Chicano movement here locally in San Jose?
That's right.
Can you talk about that, please?
Sure. Yeah, that is true. As I mentioned, I met young folks from Sal Si Puedes and in the Job Corps, and then we used to come on weekends and so on. So we got to know a lot of folks. When we moved, when we got through our training, then we moved to San Jose, and I was living right there on Sunset around the corner from Guadalupe Church. And the mailman used to come around. I used to be outside, and the mailman would always talk to me, "Son, what are you doing out here?" and stuff. And I would say, "Well, you know, I had a scholarship for television programming in Burbank, but I've been away from my family for so long, I didn't know what to do. I thought I might go back to community college, junior college it was at that time it was called. I might go over to community college and so on." And this guy, Phil Marquez, folks might know him. He was a deacon he was the head deacon at Guadalupe, but he happened to be a mailman. So he talked to me and, you know, generally gave me good advice, convinced me to go back to high school. So I called City College and they said, "Oh, no, you either have to be 18 or over or have a high school diploma." I didn't. I had a GED and I was 16. So I talked to Phil about it. He said, "I'll go back to high school," you know, and so he convinced me to go back to high school. He introduced me to the director of admissions at Santa Clara University. In those days, the Grail used to be the head, basically the center of, it was right across the street from where the CIO was formed. Cesar Chavez's family lived down the street on Stowe there and near Stowe. And Oakland Avenue was called, around the corner from Stowe, down the street from what we're talking about. And there the Grail was like the center of East Side activity, East Side civil rights. And so Phil and all these folks, including a lot of the white folks, professionals and so on that were supportive of civil rights, would meet there at the Grail. And so did the, most of the folks in those days when the Catholic Church, many activists of faith, were very active in the civil rights movement. And so the Grail was their center and they would meet there. So there he introduced me to a guy named Phil Johnson, who was the director of admissions at Santa Clara University. I also met there that first time I met Sophie Mendoza and a number of other people. I started meeting pretty regularly with the director of admissions, and Phil would just follow me for the next couple years. And when I graduated from from high school, we started at Oberfeld, but we were bused to Bema Hills. So when I graduated from there, I got a scholarship to Santa Clara University. I went to Santa Clara, and we can talk a little bit about some of my political activities, well, community activities on the East Side. So when I went to Santa Clara, I had already been pretty active in the community on the East Side. So I went to Santa Clara, I was still very, very politically active and pretty well educated by community activists. And so MASC, Mexican-American Student Confederation. And so we created a chapter there. And then later, after a year or so, we became we just renamed ourselves. But anyway, so we were very active. We became very active in the student movement. There were very few Latinos, Mexicans or Chicanos or Ricans or anybody at Santa Clara University. And so we had a chapter there. And so we worked very closely with the Latinos in La Raza student organizations at San Jose State.
Yeah, you bring up a key point. I know there was much less of a representation in Santa Clara University among Raza, hundreds, if I'm not mistaken, compared to close to 1,000, if not more, at San Jose State. So you were basically, in many ways, isolated? Is that a fair statement? Picked on?
We were very isolated. There were so few of us. Mm-hmm. There were less than 10. There were so few of us that, you could only form a student club if you had 10 or more members. And so there was five at the most. So we had to get together with the African-American students who also didn't have 10. And we formed, the Black Student Organization and then the Mexican Student Confederation chapter so that we could both become student clubs.
Interesting. Knowing a little bit about your background in terms of community organizing, can you talk a bit about Community Alert Patrol, United People Arriba, Confederación de la Raza Unida, and the impact and meaning of those organizations?
Sure. I first met Fred Hirsch at that time. This was 1966. Met Fred Hirsch when he came to the back door of my house there in Salsi Puedes, and invited us to a public meeting that they were having. And I, for some reason, didn't go to that first meeting, but a couple of my brothers and my folks went. And then the second time he came by, they had already talked to me about it. They had a first meeting that basically the meeting I missed was the first meeting of United People Arriba. They named it that night and my brothers told me about it. And so when Fred showed up at the back door, they said, "Hey, that's the guy that from the meeting." And so, so he told us about the next meeting and I certainly made sure that I went and I went. That was the first time that I was, became active on the East Side. And I went to the second meeting of United People Arriba.
Well, learning a bit about the history, because I didn't get to San Jose to 1971, but I'd certainly heard and read about the experiences of the Community Alert Patrol, the dangers involved in that.
Yes.
I've heard how police followed people, broke into people's homes and harassed them, phone calls late at night. I've heard all these stories. And I think those stories were so important in terms of the history of civil rights in America that many people don't know about. And I think it's something that needs to be talked about and remembered and honored. Can you talk a bit about the Community Alert Patrol and say some of the, shall we say, dangers that you faced?
Sure. Well, what happened was United People Arriba was working on the East Side. And what we did was we had a number of community issues. First, there was no stop signs at San Antonio on King Road. People were getting run over, especially kids were getting hurt there in traffic situations. And so we as a community organized to go down to City Hall and demand that we get a traffic light there. The school district, the Alum Rock School District, wanted to name San Antonio School the Joseph George School, who at the time was the largest liquor distributor in the community. And we thought that just wasn't right. So we advocated that we change the name to Benito Juarez, or Crispus Attucks, which was the first person killed in the Revolutionary War, which is African American, and instead, what they decided, at least we pushed them, to have a ballot sent out to all the parents, all the families, so that they could vote on the name, and that's how San Antonio School came out. So we had a number of these kinds of issues that we dealt with, and one of the most important ones was police misconduct. There was a lot of police misconduct, but worse than that, we were having the same experience that African Americans have had with the police and have, been publicized a lot lately because we have cameras. And so in those days, the Black Panther Party in Oakland had started a project of protecting the community by following police in the community to make sure that they would document instances of police misconduct. And so we basically replicated that program on the East Side. That was the Community Alert Patrol. It was because we had too many people getting shot. And after a young kid got killed by police there, a young Latino kid, Chicano kid was killed there on right on the corner of King and Story. I mean, King and San Antonio. We demanded that that we have some kind of control of the police. In those days, you know, Latinos and Chicanos could not be, were not members of the police department. I think at the most they might have two on the whole police department. They had a height requirement that that didn't allow us to join the police department, even though the even the police chief couldn't meet that requirement. He was too short. But he was a great handball player, so he got the job. But anyway, we didn't have anybody in the police department. And when they killed that kid on the corner, we decided that we had to start to try and take control of the police department. And so we created the Community Alert Patrol. Basically, what we did was we had walkie-talkies at a headquarters. We listened to any, it was only during the weekends, Friday night, Saturday night, and later we included Sunday. But the idea was whenever there was an incident, we would listen to the police monitor, police radio. And wherever there was an incident, we would have patrols in the community, cars that were equipped with two-way radios, people who had cameras and tape recorders to basically monitor the police and to conduct surveillances of any incidents that were going on so that we could both have evidence of what was going on, but also deterrence of police misconduct. So that's what we did. In those days, of course, we didn't have all the technology we have now, so we had two-way radios. And initially, we had it there at Moxa used to have an office on 13th Street. Initially, we started there, but the police gave them such a hard time that Father Tony Soto at the time was a pastor at Guadalupe Church, and he allowed us to operate from the old church, which is in the back now, is now a historical building. Was where we had our headquarters.
You mentioned Sofia Mendoza, who is a hero to all of us here in San Jose.
Yes.
Just wondering, what were the principles of community organizing you learned, and who were your mentors?
Well, you know, the main principle in community organizing, of course, is to make sure that the community is involved in all aspects of what goes on in the community. We at the time, you know, didn't really believe much in electoral politics. We were basically following an Alinsky model, which was to get the community involved in issues that were local, that were obvious, that were all encompassing. So we dealt with educational issues, with infrastructure issues, with police issues, with government issues. Anything that was going on in our community. At the time, we didn't have any sidewalks on the east side. So all those issues, terrible services. We only had one bus line that closed down at 10 p.m. so we couldn't get to the hospital. Those kinds of issues, including health issues, housing issues. We sponsored Tierra Nuestra, the first HUD project in the community. We sponsored that. We advocated for more community clinics. The Eastside Community Clinic was the first one after we sat in on, we had sit-ins that we conducted there at the county board, because we felt that people couldn't get to Valley Medical Center, with the kind of services that we had in those days. So those are the kinds of issues that we were dealing with. Health issues, all the kinds of issues, like I said, that touched the people. That was the idea, that we needed to have that kind of response. Eventually we learned, we then also, advocated for a community police review board. We started to draft an ordinance, a ballot measure, creating a police review board. But then we realized that they would be appointed by the city council. And at the time, there were seven members of the council. Six of the seven lived in Willow Glen. So we figured that's the kind of review board we were going to get. And then we realized that the problem was that no one was really representing the community on the city council or in local government. And that's when we decided to draft an ordinance, a ballot measure, districting the city council, because we realized that that was the only way we could get represented, was by districting the city. We did circulate a petition, and we almost got it on the ballot 2 weeks before the deadline of signature gathering. Norm Mineta, who was mayor at that time, got enough people on the council to put on the ballot the districting measure that included a strong mayor form of government. So it was kind of it was basically a collaboration on the city council. He got that vote, and so we stopped circulating the petition because now it was going to be on the ballot. Within a week, you know, the chamber and this what used to be called the St. Clair Club all gathered, and they turned that vote around by one vote, and so they took it off. They took it off the ballot, and we sued. Didn't get anywhere at the time. There was only one woman on the court. That's how bad it was in those days. Mario Bledo himself argued the case for us. Mm-hmm. And so we weren't able to do it then. And then later we did get district elections, and that's why we have 5 Latinos on the city council today.
I was going to say
otherwise,
that.
Otherwise, they'd all be from Willow Glen.
Yeah. It seems like most of Raza doesn't understand how impactful all those activities were. And as you said, it resulted in having... Yes. 5 members of La Raza and the city council, including 3 women, by the way.
That's right. Same thing.
And it seems like the women were the unsung heroes, and they were the true leaders in many ways, because I've talked to some women who were involved back then. I mean, they had their families, they had their marriages, and often had a job, and they were still going to meetings, and the toll that it took on people, not just the women, but it just tells you how strong the women really, really were in terms of those days. And it's something that needs to be remembered, and not enough people talk about it or understand the flow of that history. So I want to thank you for mentioning all that stuff. But even now, going beyond that, I'm blown away by your impressive resume, Tony. I mean, you've been on the grand jury, you've served on the housing task force, you've been on the personal board with the county or the city, I forget which.
Yeah, the county.
You've been in the county, okay, thank you. You've been on the Evergreen San Jose Community College District.
Yes.
You retired from the Legal Aid Society. I mean, I can go on and on and on. I mean, it's just beyond impressive. I'm curious what led you to join, to become a board member of the Santa Clara Valley Water District. What led you to that? I'm very curious about how that you ended up there.
Yeah. Well, you know... after law school, I formed a community law firm with 2 other partners. And in those days, I'm talking about 1976, 77, in those days, the big industry in town, as you recall, were canneries, where, of course, you know, 80% of the workers were Latinos, and it was mostly women, and it was during mostly seasonal. And so... we had a lot of local clients, of course, as a community law firm does. And so we had a lot of disability issues, and we had a lot of disability cases, workers' comp cases at the time. And through some of that, we got some cases of the first chemical exposure cases in the aquifer from, in those days, Silicon Valley actually... these companies actually did manufacture, unlike they do not, but they used to manufacture wafers and so on, and manufacture all of those components here locally. And that created a lot of problems with our underground water supply. And we did some of the first cases of chemical exposure. So I knew pretty well how important the water district was. In those days, it was pretty a sleepy organization, and when a vacancy came up, I applied and was appointed to an elected unexpired term, and been there ever since. So it's been this is my 24th year.
Yes, I'm glad you brought up the aquifers and the poisoning of the water. That's an issue that I myself am very, very familiar with. I grew up in the Central Valley. I grew up in Delano, and the conditions now are horrible. I mean, you go down to the Central Valley, the land is literally collapsing because of the lack of the water. Right. The aquifer is being sucked out.
Yeah.
And you throw in fracking, how the water is poison. There's many small communities in the Central Valley where it's predominantly Raza and their farm workers. And the cities or the counties could care less about improving the quality of the water. You look here in Santa Clara County, what happened with the flooding a couple of years ago, and it affected mostly minority people. I myself think that's something that really needs to be addressed. I saw a documentary a couple of years ago. They referred to water as blue gold, and I think that's very appropriate.
Yeah, it is.
And now today you see the young lady from New York City who's a congresswoman, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and her Green New Deal. So can you talk about how important it is for Raza to become aware of water issues, environmental racism, things of that nature, please?
Certainly. Well, you know, as you mentioned, water is blue gold because we basically live in a desert, an arid community. And so water has made the difference. That's what makes California rich, is the water. And unfortunately, most of us are not really aware. We become increasingly more aware. When I first got on the board, not very many of us were aware, and I mean not very many of anybody was, or anybody in the community was really aware of the whole system, the whole water system. And just like any other industry, I was basically the only one. Same thing with the community colleges, by the way. It was the same experience I had. I was the only one on the board and so on. And being the only person on the board, I had to deal with all the issues that related to us because nobody else kind of understood. The minute I got on the board, there was a complaint, a discrimination complaint that we had to deal with. And from that, it gave us the impetus to basically desegregate the water district. And now we have a Latina CEO. Most of our number twos are women and minorities. And so that's completely changed. We've changed a lot of the focus. By doing that, we create a lot more sensitivity towards the people, the public, and of course, that means also our community. And so as we've gone along, you know, we've really changed a lot of the systems. The flood system, for instance, with flooding, what happened here in the last floods was that the federal government has consistently denied us funding and permitting to create safety projects for a lot of minority communities. This is the same thing across the state, across the country, and that's because the civil works of the Army Engineers, it's the Army Corps of Engineers that has the regulatory authority and the funding for these kinds of projects. And what happens is they have a rating system that's based on the value of land and property in districts. So when we do flood control projects, we have to prove to them that those areas are worthy of these projects because the land and the houses, mostly businesses, there, the value of that is so high and so important that it's worthy of those projects. So what does that mean for minority communities? We don't even own the land. We don't even own those buildings. And so they're dilapidated. The values are down, way down. And so when they do a ratio, these projects always end up at the bottom. And all we can do, and we do, is to continue to advocate and advocate and advocate. And as a result, after the last flood projects, we were able to get the Corps of Engineers to do 10 communities, starting with us, where they completely are going to redo these ratios. And they're going to put different values, not just land, but people values. What are the losses that people experience? And again, not just money losses, but losses of life, losses of material, losses of, you know, their histories, losing all their family histories, their photos, all of their stuff. their documents. All of that has tremendous value, intrinsic values, which are not included in these ratios. So that will now change. That will definitely change some of the areas that were flooded. We also put a lot of local money together to do studies and to do the initiation of these projects so that we were able to advocate a little bit better with the Corps of Engineers. So there are different ways that we're trying to deal with it. Same thing with across the board, and especially in the Central Valley, where we have the same kind of history. The ag community controls the valley. And so the values of their product is more important to the feds and the state. And so, and thirdly, most importantly, the historical aspects of water in California is really what drives all of this. This is all historical. So the folks that have water rights go back all the way to whatever the beginning that they acquired it at. And of course, when they acquired it, we weren't allowed to own or acquire anything. And so it's the same old thing. So they have a lot of the ancient water rights that's recognized legally today. So it's very difficult for the government and for the community to get a piece of any of that, to control any of that. And increasingly with more Latinos in the legislature and, you know, obviously Democratic lawmakers and governors that understand these problems, we're starting to roll back some of these things and try to address exactly what these problems are. But it's mostly historical, that it goes back to where all these water rights were taken away from Mexicans when they took California from Mexico. And so all of those water rights continue in the hands of those people that first not acquired it, but stole it. And so that's the situation that we're in today, is if you recognize that, then we're always going to be second and third and fourth and fifth, because that's kind of the way that the laws have worked.
It seems to me what you're really saying in so many words is just you're really beating them at their own game, so to speak, learning the rules that they forced on us, so to speak, and learning how to play that game, so to speak, and then trying to address the issues that need to be addressed that way. And I'm just very curious, what continues to motivate you to do your work, Tony?
Well, you know, I learned a long time ago from these, you know, from Sophie and Fred and a lot of these wonderful people, how important it is to work for the people. You know, your own status, my own status in the community, my own life is, to me, is measured by what we do for other people, not what we do for ourselves. I learned it from people by example, people who made tremendous sacrifices. You know, Sophie and Fred and all these people, they could be gazillionaires right now. They could own all kinds of stuff. They could have acquired, you know, all that land near Reed Hillview, all that land at East Ridge, all that stuff that wasn't here then. They could have owned all that stuff. If that was what their aim was, if that's what their values were, that wasn't their values. Their values was to give back to the people, to do what you can for others. And so that's what I learned. And every day, it makes my life meaningful. I teach my kids, you know, and my grandkids that's what they need to do. And I do it by example. So it's important not just to talk about it, but to do it. You know, my kids are involved in the community, in helping people and giving back because they get it. And I do it because I got it. I had great, great examples in my lifetime.
What would you tell young people today in terms of the political climate, what they should do, what they can do? What would you tell young people to do?
Well, you know, I try to tell young folks, first of all, they need to get their paper. They have to arm themselves with knowledge, with skills, so that they have the capacity not just to be part of the society, but to be leaders in the society. And when they do, the reason they need to lead is because our folks need help. And the only way that we're going to change things is by being active in the community, being active in the economy, being active in the political world, and fighting for our folks. The only way that we can get our people out of poverty, and there's too many of us in poverty, is for us to better ourselves personally so that we can give back and we can help. It's great to want to give back, but if you ain't got much to give back, it'll be limited. Your result will be limited. Your product will be limited. But if you get a good education, and it doesn't have to be a professional education, you don't have to go to school for 800 years. It's getting a skill, being prepared so that you don't have to depend on anybody. And you can do what you got to do wherever you have to do it. So you earn a good living, take care of your family, but you can also give back to the community. It allows you, it arms you to be able to do that. And most importantly, they should always consider public service, whether it's public employment or political, you know, electoral office. That's really important. What makes a difference for us is to be engaged in public employment, but mostly in politics. You know, we're lucky, we're really lucky that in this country, we can make a difference, you know, just by voting, but so much more by being active, by meeting with people, by helping people out, by sharing knowledge, by being supportive. We can do so much. It's not stuff that you can do everywhere, you know. And in Mexico, there's a lot of limitations, a lot, tremendous amount of limitations where you have a situation almost like we're going to end up here if we don't stay involved, where, you know, the rich own and run everything and the rest of us get nothing. And that's exactly where this country's going. But for our activity, that's where this country is going to end up. The same place as Mexico, where there's no opportunity. Only rich people go to school. And so, you know, only rich people get elected. And so that's what I say, is you got to take advantage of the opportunities that are here. Arm yourself so you don't have to do anything other than work and then contribute to the community.
That was a really informative interview, Tony. I can't thank you enough. You're a voice that needs to be heard more from, and Raza Voz definitely appreciates your visit with us.
Thank you.
And the information and insights you shared with us, and hopefully we're going to inspire people, especially young people,
yes,
to get involved. And I couldn't agree with you more. The political climate that we live in, we're experiencing gentrification.
Yeah.
We're slowly getting squeezed out of the valley. And we need to all stand up and preserve our history. Personally, I feel that's what's really important. I feel one of the key things we can do to raise that social consciousness is to become aware of the history, to be aware of the sacrifices that you made. People that you mentioned, like Sophia and Fred Hirsch, Shirley Trevino, we can go on and on and on. The young people need to be aware of this, the continuity of history and how it does repeat itself, unfortunately, and the times we live in are a reflection of that. So we want to thank you again for your time.
Thank you,
Carl. And amor por mi raza.
Thank you.